So, thanks very much for the invitation. I am very honored and happy to be here, and once more congratulations to Yuri Ivanovich on the very well-deserved prize. What I will be speaking about is not unrelated to the previous talk. In some ways, both superficial and deeper ones. What we speak about is related to our attempts to understand certain aspects of quantum field theory, mostly in two dimensions, when it's related to complex analysis. And these relations make it better understood both by physicists and by mathematicians. Again, here are some discretizations which will appear, which will arise also as both as a means to understand it, but also as means to prove certain statements about the continuous case. So I will start with speaking about discretizations of complex analysis. So here, by complex analysis, we mean a theory of analytic or harmonic functions in the complex plane on Riemann surface. So we'll deal with a one-dimensional complex case. And by discrete complex analysis, we mean some discretization. So we deal with the graphs, and unlike in the graphs in the previous talks, those are planar graphs or graphs embedded in some Riemann surface. What we strive to is to define some discrete objects which would behave analogously to analytic functions in the plane or harmonic functions in the plane. So these objects appeared, especially discrete harmonic functions, in many areas. I will speak mostly about how they appear in mathematical physics and probability, and moreover, I will just restrict myself to a few very recent papers from the last 2 years with my co-authors Dima Chelkak, Clément Englert, and Hugo Dumenil-Coppin. Before we go to applications in probability theory and mathematical physics, I want to sort of say briefly on some popular level what has been done with discrete complex analytic functions before, and probably for the first time they appeared in a paper and then in a book by Kirchhoff in 1847, where he studied electric networks, which he modeled by graphs. If we assume that all edges of a graph have unit resistance, if we assume otherwise, just the formula becomes slightly more complicated with weights, then we denote by F the current flowing through an edge V. So it's an antisymmetric function. If one unit flows in one direction, then minus one flows in the opposite direction. We have two Kirchhoff laws. The first one says that unless we have some source of the current, when we sum over all edges emanating from a given vertex, we get zero. And the second says that the current around any oriented closed loop is zero. So if we deal with the planar case, the second condition is enough. It's sufficient to check for the faces of the graph, because any other contour we can rewrite as a sum of faces. Another way to rewrite this is with a potential function H. So the second condition, which says that around any loop we have some zero, essentially is equivalent to existence of function H on vertices, so that the function F is difference of H at the endpoints. We just define it by induction starting from one vertex, and condition two says that it will be well defined. And the first condition can be written as saying that if we take for all edges emanating from a given vertex V the difference of H at the ends, we get zero. So this is a discretization of sort of the easiest discretization of Laplacian. So essentially it says that our function F is a gradient of a discrete harmonic function, a function whose Laplacian is equal to zero. And in the complex plane, analytic functions are exactly gradients of harmonic functions, well, up to complex conjugate. So it's clear that what we get from the two definitions in some sense should, for planar graphs, approximate the analytic functions. So The word which is usually used is discrete analytic, which is a bit inaccurate because there are several definitions which are equivalent analytic or holomorphic or monogenic functions. And analytic, by word analytic, people usually mean that the functions have a power series expansion. So discrete analytic is not quite philosophically correct because there are no power series on the lattice. So maybe a more correct one is to say discrete holomorphic because they would be functions which have zero contour integrals or which would have a primitive. So there were several applications, notable applications of this notion, and perhaps the first famous one was in a purely combinatorial paper by Brooks, Smith, Stone, and Tutte, who were at the time undergraduates in Trinity College in Cambridge. And at the time, it was a famous open problem which appeared in a few books on recreational mathematics, whether you can dissect a square in several squares of different sizes. They did, they observed that this problem is equivalent to the problem of finding discrete analytic functions on graphs. So it's easier perhaps to show this by a picture. So on the left, there is a rectangle which is dissected into squares, and on the right, there is a graph. And each horizontal interval corresponds, on the left, corresponds to a vertex of the graph. So for example, P1, the top vertex is corresponding to the top interval, the red one, and then the blue one, P5, corresponds to the blue vertex. And then what we do, we write on an edge if there is a square between two vertices, if there is a square between two intervals, like here between blue and red ones, we write the size of this square on the corresponding edge. We draw an edge on the right, on the picture on the right, and we write the size of the square on this edge, and we write it from top to the bottom. And what happens is that the two Kirchhoff's laws, they tell, can be derived from the fact that the shapes on the left are squares. And so, for example, if we take the blue vertex, there are two edges which are incoming from the top, and we have 5 and 28 written on them, which corresponds to the size of two squares which are on the top. And there is 33, which is written on the bottom, which corresponds to the size of the square on the bottom. And since the length of the blue edge is the same, whether we measure it from below or from above, we get that 33 is equal to 5 plus 28, and then the incoming current is equal to the outgoing current. And similarly, if we want to sum around some cycle, then every primitive cycle, every phase corresponds to a vertical interval. So, for example, the vertical interval which you would have, in the middle between 33 and 36 size squares, it has two squares on the left, 2 and 36, and two on the right, 5 and 33. And the 2 plus 36 obviously is 5 plus 33. So what we get is that on this cycle, when we go counterclockwise around it, first we encounter 5 and 33 with minus sign, and then 2 and 36 with plus sign, so everything sums well. So this, besides these observations, what they did, they experimented with different graphs, and then they found an example of a square which can be dissected into squares. It somehow it's a bit bigger size than this one, so usually when you put it on transparencies, people cannot see anyway, so I decided to skip it. But this was the idea, and there were some more interesting consequences of this paper, so it goes a bit beyond recreational mathematics. But this is not quite what we want, because here the discrete analytic functions weren't considered as approximations of the usual analytic functions. So what we're interested in the graphs which are embedded in the plane. So, for example, these two different embeddings of the same graph, they are not quite equivalent for us. So what we're interested in is a planar graph, then an embedding of it in the plane, and then a certain definition of holomorphic or harmonic functions. And what we want to have some definition which in some sense would imply that these functions will be close to their continuous counterparts, especially when the mesh of the graph goes to zero. So perhaps for the first time, this was addressed by Courant, Friedrichs, and Levy for the discrete harmonic functions. And what they proved, essentially they gave a first clean proof of the existence and uniqueness of solution of the Dirichlet problem for the Laplacian operator in the plane. What they did, they considered some domain like on this picture, and then they superimposed lattice over it with a given mesh. And then what they did, they looked at the discrete harmonic function on the discretization of this domain, which has given boundary values. Then, it's fairly easy to show that it is unique, that it exists and is unique. It's much easier than the continuous case because you are basically dealing with linear algebra. And then you do the same with the smaller mesh and so on and so on and so on. So what they proved is that as mesh goes to zero, these functions, these discrete solutions, they have a limit in a fairly strong sense that they converge with all their derivatives. And they deduced that the limit is the solution of the continuous Dirichlet problem, so it's a continuous harmonic function with prescribed boundary values. Also, they stated explicitly connection with the probability, several connections with the random walk or Brownian motion, which was not sort of very rigorously defined. It was before the paper of Wiener on the Wiener process, but they stated explicitly that certain objects like the Green's functions, the exit probabilities for the random walk, they appear as a discrete harmonic functions, and they so the analogous objects for the continuous process should be harmonic functions. So we'll be interested in the same sort of philosophy, but for the discrete holomorphic functions. And here, when I was speaking about discrete harmonic functions, you can say that there is a canonical discretization of the Laplacian operator, but there is perhaps the easiest one. You say that function is harmonic if its value at every point of the graph is the mean value of its neighbors. So for the Cauchy-Riemann operator, for its discretization, the situation is not as good. There is no perhaps the most canonical or even the simplest discretization. So if we restrict ourselves to the for the moment, to the square lattice. So there, perhaps there are two discretizations which jump first to our mind. They were both introduced by Isaacs in 1941. So we want to find a discrete analog of Cauchy-Riemann equations which say that derivative of function has a complex derivative, that is, that its partial derivative in direction alpha multiplied by I will give the partial derivative in direction alpha rotated by I. So we need derivatives, discrete derivatives, that is, differences in two orthogonal directions. So the easiest way is just to say that for every square, we have this either for two sides, say bottom side and left side, or for two diagonals. So we get two slightly different discretizations. So the left one, it uses for every square three vertices. The right one uses all the four vertices. So they can be rewritten like that. And there were quite a few papers considering both of them. So for the first one, it's a bit of a skewed definition on the square lattice because we distinguish two directions. But essentially, it gives a relation for three vertices to bottom ones and the left upper one for every square. But if we add the diagonal, it becomes symmetric. So essentially, it's a symmetric definition for the triangular lattice. Only the lattice is skewed, and so the weights are not symmetric. And it was extensively explored in 40s and 50s. And then recently, there were papers written by Dynikov and Novikov and by Novikov himself. And the second definition is symmetric already for the square lattice. And I want only to make some not so important remark that for the second definition, we say that the difference along blue vector is equal to difference along the red vector multiplied by I. So if we take two blue vertices, then the difference of real parts of function there is difference of the imaginary parts of function on the red vertices. So essentially, the condition connects a real part of function on red vertices to imaginary part on blue and vice versa. So in some sense, it might be more logical to work not with a complex-valued function, but with a function which is real on red vertices or blue and imaginary on blue, or introduce some boundary conditions which will connect this. But it's not really an important remark for what we do. But similarly, for the first case, there are sort of three phases, blue, red, and orange. So it makes sense to work with the real and imaginary part on blue and red and projection on another line on orange vertices. So Why square lattice? Well, there are different generalizations of this. So the second definition, for example, it works fairly well for any tessellation in Tarombi. So this is an example of one. And the only difference is that it's slightly more difficult to work there, but still it's a fairly general class of graphs. So as far as the formulations of the theorems go, I probably will stick either with this class of graphs or with this square lattice. It doesn't seem possible to work with all the graphs and have a reasonable definition and a little bit more about this why, but nevertheless there is this class of tessellation in Tarombi which is general enough. Now, what is different between discrete complex analysis and the usual complex analysis we learn at the university? Well, there is not much difference as far as the first 20% of any textbook. You can easily prove usual theorems that the sum of two analytic homomorphic functions is homomorphic, that function has a primitive and derivative which are also homomorphic and which are defined on the dual lattice, that integral is zero along the closed contour, that there is maximum principle, etc., that the real and imaginary parts are discrete harmonic, and if there is a discrete harmonic function, there is a harmonic conjugate, so that together they give you an analytic function. Now, the problem comes when you have to multiply functions. And unfortunately, the product of two discrete homomorphic functions is no longer homomorphic. So it's very easy to see on a square lattice, for example, if you take function 1 or function z and you restrict them to the lattice, they will be discrete homomorphic. If you take z squared and restrict it, it's still discrete homomorphic. It's slightly more difficult to check, but still it is. But if you take z cubed, it no longer is. So it means, for example, that if you want to have an analog of a power series expansion, you can't just take 1 z squared z cubed. It would be more logical to take 1 primitive of 1, primitive of primitive of 1, etc. And the first three terms would be 1 z squared, but the next term already will be something more complicated than z cubed. So there is no sort of canonical way to overcome this difficulty. So one way, of course, is to introduce a different notion of multiplication, which is not pointwise multiplication, a convolution type multiplication, which in the scaling limit, if you send mesh of the lattice to zero, which will converge to the usual multiplication. But that doesn't quite work, because if you're dealing with a discrete problem, you would want to multiply pointwise. So another way is just to write some estimates saying that the product of two analytic functions is almost analytic in some sense. But here it seems that it depends on what kind of problem you are addressing. So it seems that the better way is sort of an opportunistic way that if you have a problem, you just try a solution which fits this specific problem rather than looking for a general one. So nevertheless, there are some interesting general moments, and there are also very interesting nonlinear theories, for example, related to the circle packings. And I won't speak much about it, so I'll just mention there are a few expository papers and a few books. So there is a paper of Laszlo Lovos about applications to combinatorics and computer science, and then there is a book of Ken Stephenson about circle packings, where part of the book addresses this from the point of view of discrete relations, but mostly it's a geometric way. So this was a discretization of conformal maps proposed by Bill Thurston. And then two more books by Christian Mirkai about discrete Riemann surfaces and Babenka and Suris about discretization of differential geometry. And what I will speak rather today about how these discretizations can help us in probability and statistical physics. So essentially, it's sort of a new approach to two-dimensional integrable models or two-dimensional quantum field theories. What is well known that in many two-dimensional probabilistic objects, you can exactly calculate some very complicated things. So, for example, the archetypical example is the Ising model, where since the Anzagers calculation, we know that there are very complicated things which we can write exactly. But we essentially do here, we write these very complicated things approximately, but we get a much nicer and shorter formula. So instead of having an exact expression which is long, we get a simple expression, but which is approximate. So the idea is that we look at some random object on a lattice, and then we try to find a discrete harmonic or discrete analytic function associated to it. And then if we find such a function and we say that in a given domain satisfies certain boundary value problem, then we can argue that if mesh of the lattice tends to zero, this discrete analytic function tends to an analytic function which solves the same boundary value problem. So one immediate consequence would be that, say, most boundary value problems like Dirichlet-Neumann, Magnus-Neumann problem would be conformally invariant. So it would mean that the thing which we are studying in the limit is conformally invariant. Or even, and so we would be able to deduce something from this. Or even before passing to the limit, we can argue that if we take a mesh of the lattice sufficiently small, then our discrete object should be very close to its continuum counterpart. And usually if you write some boundary value problem in continuous setting, you can say Dirichlet problem for Laplacian, you can say, well, we have a complicated domain, but if we know it's mapped to half plane, we can solve there this problem exactly, we can map it back. So here is the answer. So we obtain that in the discrete setting, our quantity in question, after, when mesh is sufficiently small, is close, it's very close to some particular expression. And it already gives us some information. Of course, another option is to say that in discrete setting, we would solve this discrete problem and it would give us an exact answer, but that would be complicated. But here we would get an easier solution, but approximate one. So there were a few models where this has been done. So I already mentioned that it was probably already sort of a folklore knowledge late 19th century about relation of random walk and the heat and the discrete version of the heat equation. But probably the first paper it's really very well explicitly stated is Kuhn, Friedrichs, and Levy. And then there was a work of Kenyon on the dimer model and myself on critical percolation, and then informed spanning tree and random cluster models. So I will mostly speak about the Ising model today, but before I will just show this slide about the percolation, because perhaps it's the sort of the thing which is the one which is the easiest to formulate. So this is the formula which was observed by John Cardy, predicted by John Cardy for the probability of crossing in a percolation. So here the model is quite simple. We take some shape, in this case it's a square, but just any rectangular shape would do, and we superimpose a hexagonal lattice over it. And then we toss a coin for every hexagon independently, and we cover it in two curves. So this is a model for a porous medium, so it's a, yellow rock with a blue hose, and the question is, what is the chance that the water will be able to seep through? What is the chance that there is a blue path from top to bottom, say from the AZ to BC? So on the top square, I think it's fairly easy to see that there is no path because there is a yellow obstruction. Now we take, well, in real life, if you study a real statistical physics problem, then what happens is that the size at which your model is defined, the size of hexagon, is several orders of magnitude smaller than the size of your observation. So you should pass to a limit or at least take it very small. So what we do on the second picture, and here it's already very difficult to see whether there is a path or not. I think there is, but, well, I'm not sure. It's, at least I can see from this angle. So the reason why it's difficult to see is that if there is a path, it will be fractal. So what it means that in the discrete setting is that, so for example, the cluster, the blue cluster, so it's not a path, but the everything which you can reach from a given blue point, if this blue cluster has size d, it will have d to the power 91 over 48 vertices, approximately. And similarly, the path will be, if it exists, it will be of dimension 4/3, so it will have d to the power 4/3 vertices. So for example, if you have a 1,000 by 1,000 square, the path, if it exists, will have 1,000 to the power 4/3 vertices approximately, which is 10,000. So it will be rather wiggly. It will be difficult. You will have to strain your eyes to see it. And the way how this was understood by physicists was that they assumed that there is a scaling limit of this object as the mesh goes to zero. And they assumed that this scaling limit is conformally invariant, invariant under all conformal transformations. And in dimension 2, it is quite a restriction because there are infinitely, there is an infinitely dimensional semigroup of conformal transformation, you can map anything bounded simply connected to a disk. So there are only a few objects of this kind, essentially one parameter family of conformal field theories. And then this allows to deduce numbers like 91 over 48 from some perfectly rigorous algebraic reasoning. So the part which was never rigorous is this sort of connection to discrete models, and in particular the two assumptions that there is a scaling limit and it is conformally invariant. So what Kardzi did here to get this formula, he mapped this domain to a half plane. And you can do this so that A, B, and C are mapped to three points of your choice, say 0, 1, and infinity. And then what he observed is that when you move Z, not only this quantity, the probability that there is a crossing, or rather its limit, but also its derivative have some physical meaning. And he obtained some Riccati-type equation, which is not solvable with algebraic functions, but essentially one of the definitions of hypergeometric function is that it's solution of this equation. So so the solution is a hypergeometric function, and gamma function arises as a normalization because the probability has to vary here between 0 and 1. And the way the mathematical proof goes is also by varying the position of point Z, but you allow it to be inside the domain. And you complexify this quantity, and then you show that this probability is a discrete analytic function in some approximate way when Z varies inside. And on the boundary, you observe that this function satisfies either Dirichlet or oblique Neumann problem on three arcs A, B, and C. And again, the solution to this Dirichlet Neumann problem for analytic functions inside is this hypergeometric function. So it's sort of, in a sense, similar to Kardzi's approach, but different. So what I want to speak about is about some newer results, and they're about mostly about the Ising model. And Ising model is sort of an archetypical model in statistical physics. It was introduced by Lenz, and then his student Ising proved in his PhD thesis that the model doesn't have phase transition in dimension one. So it has in dimension two, and the model essentially, a random object here is a covering of a plane in two covers, of a lattice in two covers. So here we have a Ising model on triangular lattice, so we cover hexagons of hexagonal lattice. And we have to specify what is the probability of given configuration. So essentially we fix a temperature type parameter x, and we say that probability of configuration is proportional to x to the power number of edges. Number of edges which separate two covers, blue and yellow. So the usual way how it's rewritten is that instead of blue and yellow covers, you write plus 1 and minus 1 spins. And instead of weights x and 1, which we have when two hexagons are of the same color or the opposite colors, you write weight exponent of minus beta spin at one hexagon times spin of another hexagon. So if x hexagons are of the same spin, then the product of spins is plus 1. So we get weight exponent minus beta. If they are of different spins, you get weight exponent plus beta. So essentially it's the same as with x and 1. You have here exponent of minus beta, exponent plus beta. And with this model, we know the exact critical value of x. It falls from Cramer's Vanier duality. So there is a phase transition at x equal to 1 over square root of 3. And also at x equal 1, which corresponds to infinite temperature for the Ising model, the weight of every configuration is 1. So all configurations are equally likely, so it's exactly the previous percolation picture. So what we expect to see in the Ising model, essentially on any lattice, is the following behavior. So that there is a critical value of x, so that whenever we're above this, when temperature is high, we're in percolation, completely disordered state, and when we're below, we're in completely frozen phase. So it's sort of clear that if we take x equal to 1, we get percolation picture, because every picture will have probability proportional to 1, so all pictures will be equally likely. And it's clear if we take x equal to 0 formally, that everything will be frozen, that everything will be of one color, because we are not allowed to take edges. So what is a bit more interesting is that actually there is a critical value xc, so that up to this value we have either disordered phase or ordered phase on two sides. And for some lattices, you can calculate it exactly because of the Kramers-Fourier duality. So for the hexagonal lattices, as I said, 1 over square root of 3. For the square lattices, 1 over 1 plus square root of 2. And on this picture, yeah, maybe I should have commented, I introduced, as in previous picture, some Dobruschen boundary values. So I asked that half of the upper half is blue and lower half is red, because these forces in existence of one interface between blue and red besides many loops. And on the right, in the frozen phase, it tries to be as short as possible. And then in the dense phase, it's something very long. I haven't pictured it. And then there is this sort of middle phase only at one point at critical temperature, where it's some interesting fractal curve. So what is a discrete analytic function in this model? So it will be more convenient to introduce it in slightly more general model. And the slightly more general model is a loop gas where we forget about these two colors, blue and yellow, and instead of writing, we just draw all the loops. And instead of saying that probability is proportional to x to the power number of edges, we say that it's proportional to x to the power number of edges and to the power number of loops. So we introduce one more parameter n, which is one for the Ising model. We also weight by the number of loops. And then there is this temperature type parameter x. And for this model, there is a similar phase transition behavior which was predicted by physicists. And essentially, it's expected that if you fix n, there are two critical values of x, which in percolation, they would, in percolation in Ising model, they would correspond to 1 and 1 over square root of 3. And then there are three, or well, four, if you wish, different phases. So there is this blue value, which is a dilute phase, which corresponds to 1 over square root of 3 in Ising model at critical temperature. And then there is a frozen phase on the left. And then there is dense phase on the right. And if you do renormalization, if you change the mesh of the lattice, roughly speaking, this corresponds in some way to changing the value of x. So if you decrease the mesh of the lattice, it would have the same effect on physical properties of the model as if moving in the direction of these arrows. So essentially, there are four fixed points for this renormalization. There are two trivial ones at infinity and zero, and there are two non-trivial ones inside. And the blue one is repelling. If you are on the left, then you are eventually going to zero. If you are on the right, you are eventually going to another critical point, which corresponds to dense phase. So for the Ising model, if I go back to this picture, then the dilute phase is a fixed renormalization point, but it's unstable. So if you want really to get to this, you have to be very careful. You have to tweak parameters at every step so that you're still going to it. And on the left, it's a percolation normalization point, a fixed point, which is attracting. So there, if you are a little bit over the critical temperature, you automatically go to it. And similarly on the right, it's a frozen phase. If you are in subcritical regime, then you will go to zero. And now, what is the probabilistic object which is discrete holomorphic? So here it's cannot be written as a probability of some event in this model. It's rather rewritten as a partition function of this model with one monodromy point. So it's again motivated by physical considerations, which I won't speak much. But what we do, we take this loop picture, and besides loop, we have one interface which goes from A on the boundary to Z, which is this time inside. So we have pictures like that. And what we can do, we can define the observer by just counting the usual partition function of this model. So for all pictures like that with A and Z fixed, count n to the power number of loops, x to the power number of edges. But if we do just this, we will get a spin-spin correlation in a dual model. So it won't be anything interesting in our context. Well, it will be something very interesting, but not in our context. So what we do the usual weight, but we add some complex weight, which counts how many turns our curve has made going from A to Z. So essentially, we count its winding in the radians. So here on the three pictures on the bottom, it's 0 pi or 2 pi. And then we take it to some, we introduce one more parameter. We take it to some fractional power. And this is the definition of our function f. So the more logical way would be to look at it as a
spinner, so it's a form dz to the power sigma form, or a parafermion in a physics language. And it turns out that if you choose appropriate values of x, specifically these two critical values of x, and you choose appropriate values of sigma, it has to be discrete holomorphic function. Here is a key lemma that if x is has a critical value as predicted by Niehaus, and we choose sigma correspondingly, so here I must say that n, our parameter n, the loop weight parameter, let me maybe scroll back a little bit, here. So the loop weight parameter n is between 0 and 2. So we can rewrite it as twice cosine of something. So it's n is rewritten as twice cosine of 2 pi k. And because formulas in terms of k look nicer. And then if we take x as predicted by Niehaus and we take sigma in the form in the counting of winding as written here, then our function satisfies the first Kirchhoff law. So I've heard someone say that every mathematics talk should have a proof. So I'm not going to give a proof, but I'm going to convince you that it's fairly easy to give a proof, or at least to check. Unless I screwed up the constants, it's fairly easy to give a proof. What happens is that to give a proof, we have to check what is the first Kirchhoff law. It says that the sum of the function over four edges emanating from a given vertex is equal to zero, or three edges in this case, it's a hexagonal lattice. So we have a vertex, we have three edges emanating from it, which I denote by P, Q, and R, and we have compare our function as these three edges. So f of p is on the left two pictures. It contains interfaces which go from a to p. F of q interfaces which go from a to q. F of r interfaces which go from a to r. What we don't know is how many interfaces like that are there and what is the exact value of f of p, because for that we need to look at the whole picture and count the loops and count over all configurations. But apparently what we can compare the relative values of f at these points. So it turns out that by simple combinatorial rearrangements around this vertex, we can define a bijection between configurations where it ends at p, configurations where it ends at q, and configurations where it ends at r. Well, say trijection between the three sets of configurations. And essentially there are two different combinatorial possibilities and there are symmetric versions. So in the first possibility is that besides loops, we have this interface from A to P, which hasn't visited our vertex before. And then what we can do, we can prolong it by two steps, either to go to Q or to go to R. Or another possibility is that there is this interface which goes to P, but the vertex is already occupied by some cycle. And then we can do one more step and erase one link in this cycle. And then we sort of reach Q, but we make a hook before that, on the left or on the right, whether we're going to Q and R. And what happens is that we don't have a control over the weights of these configurations because we don't count the loops. But what we can control is the relative weights. Because essentially, in the top row, the number of cycles is always the same, and the length is always the same. So what changes is that we add one more step on the right. We add a factor of x in two pictures on the right. And in the second picture, the middle picture, we add one turn to the right. So the weight is, if the weight of left turn is lambda, the weight of right turn is lambda reciprocal, so we add x lambda reciprocal. And with the right picture, it would be x lambda because it's a left turn. And similarly in the bottom. So what is the difference between these pictures? Well, the length is always the same because we erase something but we add something also. The left picture has one more cycle, so it has additional weight of n. And the pictures on the right, they have more turns. Actually, four more turns to the left or to the right. So the weight is lambda minus 4 or lambda to the power 4. And we have to plug it into the first Kirchhoff relation. So essentially, it's enough to check for these two triples. So essentially, it's enough to check these two equations on the top. So it's enough to check that for our values of lambda, which is weight of one turn, and for our values of n, or our values of x, two equations above hold. And what happens is that the second equation, it gives n in terms of lambda. So if we guess lambda, then we have n uniquely from the bottom equation. And the top equation, it has x and lambda. So if we have x, we can get lambda by solving quadratic equation, because there is lambda reciprocal and lambda there. And if you check carefully, then you get exactly the values of k, which I've written, exactly the values of x, which Niehaus has predicted. And the square roots arise because you have to take cosine of angle divided by 4. And dividing angle by half and taking cosine, it amounts to taking one square root. And if you do it twice, you get two square roots. So essentially, you get this lambda. So this is the first Kirchhoff law. Now, the question is, is F prehomomorphic? Well, we have to check the second Kirchhoff law. And it appears, unfortunately, that it's exactly satisfied. It is exactly satisfied only for the Ising model at critical temperature. So for this case, the weight is fermionic, so the parameter sigma is 1/2. So the weight of the full turn is -1. So essentially, if you make full turn, you don't add some complex multiplication, just multiply by -1. So the consequence is the function on a given edge essentially is a real valued function, not a complex valued function, because the weight always has the same argument. And it allows to deduce another relation from this relation, and it turns out to be the second Kirchhoff law. And there is no exact prehomomorphicity for other models, so it sort of brings us to question what we can deduce from homomorphicity and what we can do in other cases. So in other cases, I'm not sure that there is no modification of this definition where it would work. But also one can work with approximate versions, like for percolation. Also, in principle, one can deduce something even only when the first Kirchhoff law holds. So before this, I just want to state two or three theorems for the Ising model. And before I state them, maybe let me just show a disclaimer slide, because if usually I already went through it, but usually if there are physicists in the audience, they object slightly to what I say. And in physics literature, Ising model is considered a completely closed topic. It's sort of a very classical topic, which is exactly solvable and which is known to converge to field theory. And indeed, there were many papers where certain parameters were computed exactly. I just listed some people who did it in the first 15 years of the topic. Not all of these papers are mathematically rigorous, but many of them are. And later also connections after the paper of Bilan, Plekhov, Zamoyski, connections to conformal field theory appeared. Well, even before conformal field theory existed, there were connections via the bosonic field. And it allows to calculate many things. And what one expects to see at criticality, that there is a scaling limit. It is universal, independent of the lattice, and is conformally invalid. But this was never fully and rigorously established, and even there are some problems with parts of physical motivations for this. And now, for example, for lattice, if you map a square lattice, obviously you get a different lattice, so the discrete model is different. So it's a big question why, when you pass to the scaling limit, you should get the same scaling limit in the case of the square or square mapped conformally. And if you map conformally part of the plane, you should address the question of boundary conditions. You can't just cut out a part of the plane and map it. That won't work. That won't be conformally invariant. You have to define some boundary conditions. So what we do is we address rigorously this question, but also we do some things which weren't computed before. And this is the first theorem. It's about observable f of z, which I said, and the theorem is that as mesh of the lattice goes to zero, this observable has a conformally covariant scaling limit. So you have to normalize it properly itself, it goes to zero, so you divide it by square root of the mesh of the lattice, and then f of z over square root of epsilon converges to square root of derivative of the Poisson kernel, or rather Schwarz kernel. You take a harmonic function in your domain, which has a singularity at A. So it's basically its boundary values are zero everywhere and delta measure at A. It's called Poisson kernel. If you add complex conjugate, you get an analytic function. It's called Schwarz kernel. So what you do, you take its derivative and you take square root. So this is covariant as a square root of DZ form, and this is the limit. Now, what one can deduce from this theorem, and this holds on all these rhombic lattices I mentioned, is that the interface in the Ising model will converge to Schramm's SLE curve. So if you take Dobruschen boundary conditions like on this picture, that there are plus spins on one side and minus spins on the other, and then besides loops, there is one interface running between two points, then this interface converges to fractal, conformally invariant fractal curve introduced by Edet Schramm. So it's the so-called Schramm-Lovner revolution with parameter 3. If you do random quasi-reversion, it's with parameter 16 over 3. And this is actually deeper than just looking at one interface. You can generalize this. It hasn't been done yet, but you can generalize this to look at all the interfaces. There are branching versions of this curve. So this gives some geometric insight. And for example, the dimension of this curve is 11 over 8. This also falls from it and corresponds to some scaling exponents for the easing model. Now, what if we don't pass to a limit but stop before? What kind of things we can deduce? So this is an example of what happens if we take our observer with both of the points inside. So we have this interface not from A to Z, A on the boundary, but from A to Z inside. So essentially we have this easing model where there are loops, but there is also this funny interface running between two points. Now, what happens if we take these two points nearby? Then we have a bunch of loops, but we also have an interface which goes from this point and arrives back to its neighbor. If we add the edge between, it becomes a loop. So essentially we can retrieve probability that there is an edge at this point. We can retrieve probability that two nearby spins here are of different sign, which is called the energy field of the easing model. So what we get this joint work with Clément-Englert, we get a rigorous proof that the discrete energy field converges to its, or rather one point function of it, converges to its continuous counterpart. And, well, here is the statement that if we take the expected value of product of two spins nearby, then the first term is 1 over square root of 2. This essentially falls from the critical temperature as defined by, as deduced by Kramers and Vanier. And the next term, it was expected from conformal field theory that it should be something conformally covariant. And if you have a domain and one point inside, essentially there is only one conformal invariant. It's the conformal in radius of the domain. You map it to a disk and this point to a center, and it will be derivative of this map. Or, equivalently, you can look at the element of hyperbolic distance here. But the coefficient in front wasn't known. So what we do, we prove it rigorously, but also with the coefficient in front. So the next term is plus minus, depending on which boundary conditions you use, 1 over pi times the element of hyperbolic metric times epsilon. And then it's all up to O capital of epsilon squared. And what Clément-Englert did later himself is the similar formula for spin pair correlation. So you take n pairs of spins, and there the formula, it sort of becomes more complicated. There is some Pfaffian formalism, and if you sort of move one point around the other, things, well, for example, in this observer, things get multiplied by minus 1, but it's exactly what is predicted by physics. Only exact constant are obtained. So essentially, his theorem says that the energy, discrete energy field converges to the energy field, continuous energy field as studied by physicists, and this field, it's not a random distribution in the sense of Laurent-Schwarz, but it's a, say, more general random distribution in the sense of Colombo. And it seems that one can go beyond that. Particularly, it seems that one can do spin correlations, but this is sort of a work in progress. So I have to finish in 2 minutes. So I wanted just to say what one can do if there is no exact homomorphicity. So this is a joint result with Dominique Coupin about a model which was proposed by Paul Fleury as a model for polymer chains. So it's essentially this model with n equal to 0. So we don't have any loops, we have only one interface. So we want to know how a single interface behaves. So essentially it's a self-avoiding random walk, so we take all trajectories of random walk, which are simple. And the first question one can ask, so this was proposed by Fleury as a model of a polymer molecule which obviously can't intersect itself, how many such things will be there? If we take, say, hexagonal lattice and we take n steps of or along it, and we count the number of such trajectories, C of n, what will be asymptotics of C of n? So it's easy to see that C of k plus l is no more than C of k times C of l. It's just because if you cut a simple trajectory into two, both parts are simple. But if you glue together two simple curves, it's not necessarily simple because two parts might intersect. And from this it follows that there is a constant mu, which also plays a role in some other questions in probability, so that C of k grows like mu to the power k. And in-house, using Coulomb-Gauss methods, actually proved, physically proved, that C of k should grow as square root of 2 plus square root of 2. This is one of these square root weights on the slide before, to the power k, with a correction k to the power 11 over 32. So the square root of 2 plus square root of 2 is lattice dependent. So it's like boiling temperature of a liquid. It depends on the liquid. But the next term is universal. It's sort of thing which falls from the renormalization picture. So what we can do is the first part is the square root of 2 plus square root of 2. And essentially the reason why we can do it, because there is this observable. We only have first Kirchhoff's law, but it still gives you some global information. It tells you that, contour integrals, real part of contour integrals is zero, so it lets you do some estimates. And if you are interested, there will be talk about it tomorrow, so I explain it in more detail.